dissimilar meaning than that.
So you give me the high sign when the tape starts.
It's going.
The tape's going. They were like men who came not only from different planets, but different galaxies. Labor was so serious, so intense. Ollie Crenshaw suspected that Laban was a Yale atheist, but in this town there was no place for overt atheism. And the only way to plug into the town to acquire respectability, and I've got to tell you a funny story about this also, was to be either Presby or Episcopi, one or the other. And so Laban hooked up with the Presbyterian Church upon arriving here. And Dr. Crenshaw was absolutely convinced that a man who had taught sociology at Yale for 20 years was an atheist. And that the sincerity of Laban's Presbyterian attachment was completely phony, that there wasn't a single sincere fiber in Laban's body, first of all, and in his religious affiliation as well. Not that Ollie Crenshaw was religious. I suspect that he wasn't, because of various sarcastic little remarks he made, just fleetingly. But I think the Crenshaws may have gone to church once a year, to the Episcopal church, just to put the tiniest pinch of incense on the altar, the tiniest possible pinch of incense. But Laban was more assiduous in going to the Presby temple. And Laban's only friend, and it must have been a somewhat aloof and rather stuffy friendship, if the word friendship fits, was a retired Presbyterian minister who lived here in the town, and who was pretty icy himself, as I gathered. And these two icebergs would occasionally visit and perhaps have tea or coffee or something. No, not coffee, that's too low class. Tea together. Was always a picture that sort of amused me, Laban and the Reverend so-and-so who lived here in the town. These two cold fish, thinking that they were friends was sort of strange. Was Laban, it's hard to imagine, Laban actually, I think, was probably a space alien, and the idea of his being friends with any Earthling, any mortal on this planet, is an impossibility. And I'll admit my view of Laban is greatly colored by one lunch conversation after another, day after day and year after year, with Dr. Crenshaw, for whom hatred of Laban was oxygen. And I will say I've never heard or seen anything in Laban that contradicts what Dr. Crenshaw said. Everything he said, it was consistent with what I could observe and pick up from other people. I don't know that Laban was an evil man. I think he was just devoid of emotions and the psychological structure of an earthborn inhabitant. So a lot of Ollie Crenshaw's conversation was about this arch enemy of his. Obviously, you can't put this in the book because that would not be consistent with a pleasant portrait of the school. But
it's very interesting.
But
to know that dynamic.
Yeah, I think it is interesting for you, the writer, I assume the chief or the only writer of the book, for you to know this, that these two men who were born very close together, one in 02, Laban was born in 02 and Ollie Crenshaw in 04. So they were closely, what's the word, contemporary and co-evil. I guess an old person and a newborn baby can be co-evil. They're living briefly at the same time. Well, at any rate, these two guys hated each other.
That's interesting that you're bringing up this theme of people being in the same place at the same time, mm-hmm, because yeah. One of the things, I'm going to jump here.
Yeah, go ahead.
One of the things that two of the interviews that I've done recently were with people who attended Washington and Lee from in the years 1969 to 74. So they were here, they were both here at the same time. One of them led the traditional Washington and Lee life, and the other one got involved in the alternative lifestyle that was here at that time.
Doug Harwood would be such a one, for example.
Well, that's not who I'm talking about, but yes, he would be.
He was very alternative.
He would. He still is.
He was highly alternative.
He still is.
Yeah, he still is, yes. Yeah.
And it was fascinating to me because it was like these two people were talking about entirely different places, well, and yet they were talking about the same place at the same time. So I think I'm fascinated by that time period here because I think it's an extraordinary time here, and I mean that in the sense of it being extraordinary. It was not
yes.
a normal time,
oh,
and yet
right.
it was a very dramatic and historical time. And you were here.
Oh,
what
yes.
was your experience, especially of what went on here in May of 1970?
Oh, yeah, well, I can say something about that. My feeling was that that a certain minority of the students, a small number, wanted to reenact what they saw on TV at other campuses. I think very few, if any, were genuine radicals. The faculty, on the other hand, included a few, such as Mario Pellicero. What's the guy who, Mario is still here. This is a man who left after about 3 years. And you may have heard, what was his name? Henry Sloss, S-L-O-S-S. Have you heard about him?
Just people who were here then have mentioned his name.
Okay, he was in the English department, and you can easily check this out in the catalog, circa 1968 to 1972, perhaps. A rather short time, but he, I think, took the whole radical peacenik thing very seriously, hated traditionalism in every form, as Professor Boatwright did, although that was a story the Boatwright story is one I knew a great deal better, if only because he was here a long time, and Sloss was here very briefly. But those two men, I think, wanted to see every tradition, capitalism, sexual relationships, every single tradition of society ripped up and reshaped in utopian ways. And I am told that I have no personal knowledge of this, that Henry Sloss's leaving the faculty was a matter of departmental trauma in the early 70s, and that the reverberations of his departure affected his department for many, many years, personal relations within the department. But the extraordinary radicalism of Henry Sloss was probably the most significant influence on the campus in May of 1970. He, having been here a very short time then, and he was destined to remain a very short time after that period. But there was no student radicalism to speak of, quantitatively. And it was significant that one of the rumors of Kent Cambodia Week, which I guess 10 days, the first 10 days of May of 1970, I've always thought it was significant that the most interesting rumor was that radicals from UVA, which sounded like would have sounded like a contradiction in terms a couple of years earlier, but it was a bigger school, so there were probably more, maybe not in percentages, but there were probably more radicals in absolute terms at UVA than here, that they were going to come down to WL and vandalize property, Lee Chapel and other places here, to let Richard Nixon and the whoever, Melvin Laird, I guess, was Secretary of Defense, and John Mitchell, the Attorney General, these hate objects of the radicals of that day, let them know how mad the students were. And to my knowledge, no UVA radicals ever set foot in Lexington. But it was as though the rumor mongers of May 1970 here were saying, there aren't enough radicals here to accomplish anything, and therefore this network of peaceniks with presumably a foothold at UVA would send somebody here to stir up the pot at WNL in the absence of indigenous radicals at WNL. And of course no property was vandalized at WNL. I don't recall whether any was at UVA or not. But the radical impulse was extremely weak overall, though there may have been one or two virulent characters. And certainly Henry Sloss was probably a mental case. For one thing, Henry Sloss and his wife both came from rich families. And so they had no reason to worry about job security, for example. If he made his colleagues or made the administration angry, it didn't matter, because they were both rolling in money. And what happened was that when Henry Sloss lost his job a few years later, he and his wife moved to Italy, bought a villa or some sort of house in Tuscany, and lived sort of like Victorian English people who had so-called private incomes in 1850, living in Italy. Mm-hmm. So it's easy and fun to play act at radicalism if one has two big financial cushions to fall back on, his family and her family. At any rate, the decision, one of the decisions, I guess the only memorable decision made was that in May of 1970, there were two faculty meetings held in Reed Hall, which was not the usual place for faculty meetings. I don't know why a different building was used. But there were two nighttime faculty meetings held in addition to the regular monthly one in May of 70 to deal with the supposed explosive mood of the students. And the decision that came out of all this was that any student who was in a moral tizzy about the invasion of Cambodia and the shooting by the National Guardsmen at Kent State, any student who was emotionally or morally furious about this, the Italians have a word, sconvolto, meaning overturned, turned upside down, about this, could postpone the final exams, which were coming up, of course, at the end of May, could postpone the exams until no later than September the 30th. It could take them any time at the beginning of the next academic year, which, when you look back on it, was not a very wise idea, because people forget things. Students forget material that they were supposed to have learned in one semester. They forget the material by the end of the summer vacation, all the beach fun and games. So this academically was not a very wise idea, and I don't know how many or how few students accepted this arrangement. But some did, and during final exam period left town. And very conservative students told me that they, instead of taking final exams, they were going to leave and take the final exams in September. And I said, well, you're free to do that according to the faculty's decision, but it seems academically unwise. I said, so if you're leaving town, where are you going? They said, oh, Virginia Beach. And I said, Virginia Beach? What are you, you're not going to protest the war in Virginia Beach, are you? He said, no, we're going to enjoy the swimming and drink beer and look for girls at Virginia Beach. And so that it had nothing to do, their postponing the exams had nothing to do with war protesting or moral indignation against anything. They just wanted to hit the beach a few days earlier than they otherwise would have, maybe a week earlier. So the radical impulse here was very weak overall, but Henry Sloss and a very tiny handful of students, there was a boy named Jeffrey Gingold, G-I-N-G-O-L-D, whose name you'll find, I'm sure, in the alumni roster. And I'm told is still living out in the Pacific Northwest. So he was sort of a radical wannabe and play-acted at revolution. And Henry Sloss was play-acting at, or maybe more, maybe he wanted a revolution, I don't know. But there was this one nutty student and one nutty professor, and I think very few others.
Well, one person I interviewed from that time period sent me an amazing body of material that was published at that time on mimeograph machines, mm-hmm. It looks like.
Oh, that may well be.
And it was there were probably 300 pieces of paper.
But a very small handful of people can do that.
Published within 10 or 12 days.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and it was just a, I don't know that that happened at other campuses. I was just impressed with it. It seemed like a lot was put out.
The stuff may have disappeared that was at Columbia and Kent State and Berkeley, but I'm sure that if we had kids using a mimeograph machine, that a lot of campuses must have had it. Mm-hmm. Because this campus was one of the least fiery, or what would you say, hysterical, at the time. So I would think that maybe 5 or 6 students in the space of 10 or 12 days could grind out.
Did you attend that faculty meeting?
Oh yes, there were I believe 2 extra faculty meetings in addition to the normal, and the regularly scheduled faculty meeting is the first Monday of a month. And then, so that maybe that was May 3rd. I don't have the calendar here. So if that was May 3rd, then there was another one, say, on May the 7th, and then another one on May the 10th.
And what was the mood in those meetings?
I would say surprisingly calm. The conversation didn't drag. I didn't say anything which I've known for all these years that a conservative's opinions would be discounted instantly. So I had never spoken in a faculty meeting in 34 years now. But I had the feeling that while every minute of the faculty meeting was taken up with contributions. But I mean, there was never a time when the president said, do we have any other comments? Does anybody else want to say anything? Somebody's hand was always up. But it seemed to me that the mood was not hysterical. It was polite, and well, I guess some people spoke with a certain intensity. It was not like the French Revolution. Those demented assemblies of the French Revolution were quite volatile. It wasn't like that.
Now, so, was your sense that the faculty was more or less or equally radical?
Oh,
the students. Was it just one or two members of the faculty?
I think very few faculty members were radical. Mm-hmm. There was a man who is now still living in his 90s, who was a department, probably an outgoing department head at the time, who had sort of a fixation on the Russian Revolution. He remembered the Russian Revolution. If he's in his 90s now, of course, he remembers the Russian Revolution as a teenager. And he never fell out of love with the Bolshevik Revolution of November 1917. And students told me that he wanted the American students to create sort of a hammer and sickle revolution in this country. But he's so much older than I mean, he lived in Paris in the 1920s and used to see Gertrude Stein and Hemingway and Scott Fitzgerald walking the streets of the Latin Quarter. So he was a faculty member at the time, though on the verge of retirement, I think, and was sort of an armchair radical screwball. And then Henry Sloss, this very young man, probably in his, not over 30 at the time, probably, who was a radical. But I think most of the professors were sort of worshippers of FDR and JFK. And so that meant that they were armchair liberals and theoretical leftists, but they weren't going to go out on the barricades at all. So it was a faculty whose radicalism was limited to cocktail parties, praise of LBJ's legislation, that sort of thing.
Now, you touched on this a little bit with Richard, but I'd like to pursue what I think is just a really interesting dichotomy that goes on at this school, that the faculty seems to be liberal and the student body is conservative.
Oh yeah, there's no doubt of that.
How does that work? Why does it work so well here?
Because people are polite. If the student body came, or if the faculty maybe came from a different socioeconomic background, there might be rudeness and shouts and insults. But I think that whether by design or by happenstance, so many of the people come from similar backgrounds that politeness is a is a virtue that has been respected here for a very long time. And I think maybe some of the people who come here from more humble backgrounds quickly realize that politeness is a cardinal, maybe the cardinal virtue here, and they quickly get with the program. Rudeness and confrontationalism, if I don't know if that word exists, rudeness and confrontations are not part of the picture here. And so that's how it gets along. The political differences are extremely deep between left-wing faculty who are the majority, of course, and the right-wing students, who are the majority.
Now, when you arrived in 1962,
it was very true then.
Were the faculty was liberal?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Then?
Yes. Now, of course, you understand that in 1962, the definition of liberal was very different, because the Kennedys were just taking hold at that time, and so leftism in 1962 was defined as Roosevelt, Truman, Adlai Stevenson, and JFK, whom we look back on JFK as being a conservative in some ways because of his tax reduction and his confronting the Soviets, his risking war in Cuba over the missiles. So now, 30-some years later, JFK looks conservative, but he was regarded as a big liberal at that time. So that was what liberalism was at the time.
And he was, at that time, he was embraced by the faculty, but not the student body.
Oh, that's right. And I'll tell you another story in a moment along this very line, so remind me. The students hated JFK because he was perceived, the Democrats were perceived as liberals at that time. The faculty, of course, bought into the New York Times-Arthur Schlesinger cult of worship in JFK even before he was assassinated. They liked the idea of Camelot, and this young couple, handsome Jack and lovely Jackie, who incarnated the hopes of a new generation. Remember, he used the metaphor in his inaugural speech about passing the torch, the old, tired, bald-headed, white-fringed, white-haired Eisenhower generation was tottering off into decrepitude, and the young, vigorous World War II generation of JFK were coming on, and the faculty just ate that up. And I very quickly realized that I had better not say a word about politics at these many faculty cocktail parties when I arrived here, and of course kept very quiet entered eagerly into conversations that had to do with Lexington and W&L, and kept very quiet when the Kennedys or later LBJ came into the conversation. So the faculty was very politicized and liberal, according to the definition of liberal, in the early 60s.
Well, my impression, one of the first people I interviewed was Charlie McDowell.
Oh, big liberal.
And and I got the impression from him that his parents were considered really radical. That would have been the 30s.
Especially
yeah.
His father.
So somewhere in there, the faculty changed.
Well, yeah, I would imagine the faculty did change in the 40s and 50s. But see, I wasn't here in the 40s and 50s. The only access that I have to the change in the faculty is what Olinger Crenshaw told me at lunch, because we had lunch 4 days out of five.
So would Ollie Crenshaw have been a liberal?
No, not at all. Now that you have just hit on an interesting point, and again, I don't know how you'll put whether you can put this in the book. Ollie was an old Harry Byrd Democrat. You know the history of Virginia politics. Mm-hmm. So Harry Byrd Sr. was an extremely important figure in the political life of the 40s, 50s, and 60s. But of course, by the 60s, by the time I arrived, Harry Byrd Sr. was elderly. He had a stroke about 1964, 65. And his son, who was equally conservative, took over that seat. but the son did not have a forceful personality, and the Voting Rights Act of 65 prevented the son from taking hold of the state of Virginia in the same way that the father had done. Now, this is not irrelevant to the Lexington Heights and faculty scene. Harry Byrd's position, of course, depended on white supremacy in Virginia, and that was a major part, along with not chalking up any state debt. That those were major components of the Democratic ascendancy in Virginia as it was understood in the 40s, 50s, and the early 60s. But there was another element in the Virginia Democratic Party that never took hold in those days, but W&L, for some reason, was very attached to this, and it was called the Francis P. Miller, Francis, the male spelling, masculine spelling, F-R-A-N-C-I-S. Francis Pickens Miller was an alumnus of about 1910 or 1920, who was an advocate of racial equality and, of course, was a deadly enemy of Harry Byrd, Sr., the senator, who was senator for many, many, many years. And Francis Miller ran against the Byrd machine for, and we'll get back to Ollie Crenshaw, I haven't forgotten your question.
Mm-hmm.
The Francis Miller faction of the party kept, they couldn't defeat Harry Byrd, but they administered pinpricks for a senatorial election here, a gubernatorial election there. And the Lexington, the cream of Lexington society, was hooked up for some reason with the Francis P. Miller liberal brand of at that time, unsuccessful intra-party rivalry with Harry Byrd. And so if one wanted to go to Lexington cocktail parties with the Penicks and the Paxtons, one would, of course, supposedly be on the Francis P. Miller and the anti-Harry Byrd wavelength. Ollie Crenshaw, however, did want to go to cocktail parties, but he did not in any way sympathize with that faction at all. He was absolutely a conservative, an old-line Southern Democrat conservative of a very old vintage. But if he had said that at the cocktail parties, the invitations would have dried up. So this is what I meant by saying that he was a mesh of diplomacy and euphemism and circumlocutions and elliptical speech. And so he managed to, it must have been an amazing performance for decades for him to be accepted as a Lexington Democrat, while he was deep down a conservative Harry Byrd Democrat during all of those years. And that was done by talking about old Miss So-and-so, who said the funniest thing back in 1918, and on like that. And so Ollie Crenshaw was an earned conservative. Laban, for example, was a great apostle of racial liberalism in the 40s and 50s, and Ollie very discreetly, if he were living, I wouldn't be telling you this, and I trust this won't be in the book at all, but he was not sympathetic to that stance, and so just for a record that may be unsealed 100 years from now, that was one of the problems between Ollie and Laban. And I doubt if they ever discussed it, because as I say, Ollie Crenshaw was not into confrontations and quarrels and arguments. But he at these lunches with me, he made it clear, though in a rather oblique way, nonetheless clear, that he disliked everything about Laban, everything. If you had asked him to say something good about Laban, he would have said, well, he dresses nicely. That would have been it. The white hair is becoming, perhaps. So Ollie Crenshaw was a diplomat. It's no wonder he taught U.S. diplomatic history in the courses, because he himself was an extremely skillful diplomat. And of course, he continued with the cocktail circuit till the week he died. Now, his son is still living. That's another reason I don't want anything said.
I understand.
Or printed.
I understand.
And the son is not old either, so.
Well, I hope
Well, the son was born when Ollie was no kid.
I hope that this book will be inclusive but discreet.
Yes, discretion is extremely important. And I emphasize that I'm a great fan of Ollie. He treated me like a son. Well, it was as though I had two fathers, the one in Baltimore and the one here. And I knew him for 8 years. But I first met him in April of 62 during an interview visit. And he lived until March of 70. So for 1 month less than 8 years, I knew him very well. Mm-hmm. And he opened up increasingly to me as the years passed.
Now, all right, let's stay with speaking of academic things. Richard said, I should ask you about the H train.
The H train.
The history train. That's apparently a term that the students use. Is that something?
Not around me.
Oh, that you can take the H train around the world by taking different courses about different kinds of history?
They never talk.
All right. Well, then I won't expect you to tell me about that.
Oh, no. Students are very... Something like that makes me think that they're more discreet than I realize.
No, I don't think it's anything critical. I think it's not remotely.
Oh, I thought this was something negative.
No. Oh, no, no, no.
Oh, well, good. If it's favorable, I'm happy.
No.
But I...
Oh, no, no. You can take the H train and see the world through your history course.
Oh, well, good. Well, that's fine.
I think that's
I'm
what
glad, I'm glad to hear that, but it's a brand new term to me.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that's one of the interesting things, speaking to someone as young as Richard. He thinks that the way it's been for the last 4 years is the way it's always been.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, you and I know differently. He's a nice kid. He's extremely smart and pleasant. He's a sphinx, though. You never know what he's thinking. He has a deadpan way about him.
He does.
And I sometimes look at him and wonder what's going on behind that face, behind the mask.
I think it's his journalism background.
Maybe that is
keeps
a
that blank
maybe
look.
That is something that they're trained or that they learned to pick up.
I think
but
so.
But I'm very fond of him. He's always been very, very polite and nice.
Well,
easy to talk to for me.
I think so too. Yeah. So how about this great legacy of students that you have taught through the years? Have you kept up with people?
Oh, many, many, many of them, yes. Going back into the 60s, very much so.
Tell me about that. How do you keep up with them?
Correspondence on a manual typewriter. I couldn't begin to deal with a computer. I would probably have to be institutionalized if I were put in a room with a computer. So I have a whole bunch of manual typewriters, which, by the way, are still being manufactured. I'm told from missionaries who go to jungles, and they can't plug a manual typewriter into a palm tree. So. That's how I keep up with them. I'm not a telephone buff at all because it's very time consuming. I found that very few people will talk for 10 or 15 minutes and hang up. So my telephone contact with alumni is extremely rare. But I'm very glad to write letters and love getting letters from alumni. And that's how it's done. It's a very 1930s way to keep up with people.
Well, it's nice to know. You know, I often worry that those personal records, there just aren't going to be many of them from this time period because we're all doing email
and
telephone.
And I will say that I keep the letters of all of the wittiest students, mm-hmm. or alumni, I should say. So that is going to be quite something. If I leave those letters behind.
Well, I certainly hope you will.
Yeah, I don't have any plan to destroy them, but certainly I would have to be 6 feet under before a lot of them are read. But I have a great number of personal letters, and I'm making an effort now as I go through the debris that I live in. I always call my house the harbor bottom. I'm trying to put them all in one place and I have some big stacks of correspondence, and I guess I will make these letters available to somebody. But I do not have any intention to burn them. When Queen Victoria died, one of her daughters and a courtier spent 10 years burning papers that were I guess the most interesting things are the ones that got burned.
Oh.
What is left is much less. A huge lot is left, but they burned, goodness knows what, for 10 years. Princess Beatrice and Lord Esher did the burning.
They weren't historians,
they
obviously.
Were not. So I don't have any plan at all to do that. But I do keep up with, getting back to your question, with big, considerable numbers of students. Those who write letters, there are those who are not fond of writing letters. There are some with whom I've fallen out of touch because they are strictly electronic young men, and I'm absolutely terrified by anything having to do with electronics. I tell people that for me, technology is whatever existed in 1940. And thank heaven manual typewriters did. The technology of my elementary school days will be quite sufficient.
So, what else do you want to talk about? What haven't we talked about?
Oh, what haven't we talked about?
Now, we talked about a lot of interesting things before we turned the tape recorder.
Let me, yes, indeed. Indeed, we did. I wondered if there was anybody I want to put you in touch with. In fact, I am going to contact a few people and say, would you be willing to talk to Mame Warren about so-and-so, either on tape or otherwise, perhaps.
That would be wonderful.
I will be glad to do that. Photographs, I will rack my brain to come up with somebody who might have pictures. Now, there's a professor who may or may not be mentally able to help you now. He graduated in 1923, taught math here, living here in the town, incidentally. He taught here, I guess, from the 20s until he retired. He was born when 1900, I guess. Winter Royston, do you know that name?
I've heard the name. Do you know what kind of condition he's in?
I do not know, but I'm sure you can find out from the math department. He lives on the street next to my street. I think it's called Edmondson Avenue here in Lexington. Mm-hmm. R-O-Y-S-T-O-N? Or T-E-N, I forget which was. Mm-hmm. He and his wife live in a house that I sometimes drive by. And they are in their 90s now. Of course, I don't know whether he was born in 1900, 1901, 1902, 1903, but he graduated in 23. He might have some photos, possibly. Very, very nice man. And he and his wife were driving their car around until they were in their late 80s. And I assume they're still living in that house. And I'm sure that the senior level math teachers could tell you whether either one of the Roystons is in a position to talk about the 1920s with you.
You know, I sure would like to find somebody who can talk about that. I'd like to find out about bathtub gin around here.
Oh, yeah, well, Ollie Crenshaw told a story about the bathtub gin. He said that if a student would stand on the corner of Main and Washington Streets, where Grand Piano now is, as he put it, a black young man would, and sort of, if one stood there and sort of gazed around the sky, a black young man would figure out what the WL student wanted and would appear within a few minutes and say, anything I can do for you today? And you say, well, yeah, I sure would like to have a gallon of this or that. And he'd say, well, I'll if you want to go in the drugstore and have a soda, I'll be back in about half an hour. And that you would make the arrangement right there on the street corner. Now, whether the delivery was made on the street corner, who knows? And I suppose very few blacks had automobiles in the 1920s, so it must have been within walking distance. But he said that bathtub gin was very, well, I don't know that Ollie Crenshaw ever used a word like bathtub gin, but he would have said illegal products were easily gotten in the 1920s. He also told me another funny story that you might want to have. Are we still on tape here?
Mm-hmm.
He laughed and laughed over the fact that the president of the university in the 1920s unwittingly perjured himself before a congressional committee because either the House or the Senate held hearings, a committee of the House and the Senate held hearings on the effectiveness of prohibition. And that President Henry Louis Smith of WNL was an ardent prohibitionist, believed in it very sincerely, and went up to Capitol Hill to testify before such and such a committee that prohibition was working fine. He said, "I am the president of a school for young men, and I can personally assure you that prohibition is absolutely successful in Lexington and on our campus." And Ollie Crenshaw said that it was like a sieve, and that getting booze was the easiest thing in the world. And the president lived as faculty members usually do live, unaware of how the students are living, that the president was just oblivious, or as they say today, clueless, and assured under oath the senators or representatives that prohibition was completely successful here in Lexington, and it was anything but. So that is an Ollie Crenshaw story that he told with great peals of laughter, since he was anything but a prohibitionist. And I've always said that Ollie Crenshaw looked like the type who ought to be sitting in a white suit on the veranda of a white columned mansion with a mint julep in one hand, or maybe in both hands. he enjoyed the product of fermentation.
You know, I don't have any pictures of him. Crenshaw, I would love to have a photograph.
Well, in the I'm sure in any calyx you ought to be able to find one.
Right, but I'm talking about that kind of picture of him sitting back with the julep.
No, I'm sure there's no picture. Oh, I thought you meant just any photo. No, I wish he had posed for that, but he took the university and the professorship so seriously that he would never have posed humorously for such a picture. No, I misunderstood your point. What else? Mr. Mattingly, the treasurer. There was another enemy of Ollie Crenshaw. Do you want to hear about Mr. Mattingly?
Well,
or
sure, but
I
should.
Tape?
We're just about the end of the tape.
Do you want to meet another day?
We can continue on.
You have another tape?
I have another tape. Of course I have.
I should have known. Yeah. Well, by all means.
All right. I'm going to put in a new tape.